Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. We are holding now in our Mashiach Matters class, and we are holding Parshas Toldos, Pasuk Chavav, Perek Chavhei, Pasuk Chavav. We're holding by the birth of Yaakov. Last week we learned about the birth of Esav. And the pasuk says, Before we get to that pasuk, I'm going to share with you just one last thought on pasuk Chav Hei. It says the first one went out, Admoini. He was a redhead. He was covered with hair, like a coat of hair. And they called him Esav. There's a fascinating medrash which I'd like to share with you. The medrash states as follows. That there was a king, the Medrash Rab over here in Parshas Toldos. There was a king, his name was Cleitinus. This must have been some kind of one of the Roman emperors. Initially, he was a shepherd for pigs. And this was in the vicinity of Tiberias, of Tveria. And what happened was that Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the author of the Mishnah, he had a lot of students. And when the students came towards the time when there was a special program, maybe it was a Yarchi Kala, it was a time when Rabbi was going to give a special talk, special classes, special teaching, and many students gathered. And this guy was the shepherd for the pigs. So somehow, I don't know, if who was the one who instigated it, but whatever it was, the students of Rabbeinu HaKadosh beat him up. They beat him up, and you know, not always a good idea. Many years later, this guy, the shepherd of the pigs, even though he was had very low, humble beginnings, he ended up becoming the emperor. And when he became the emperor, of course, he remembered what the Jewish people had done to him, and he wanted to give them back their shear, God forbid. So what did he do? He came and to the vicinity of Tiberias, not exactly there, he came a certain distance away. He came to a place called Pamyas. Now where exactly Pamyas is, I'm not exactly sure where this is, but this is where he came. And he sent a letter to the Jewish people that he wants they should come see him at his residence, where he is, where he's staying now, Sunday morning. Sunday, maybe he said, 7 a.m. or 9 a.m., I want you to be at my place. And this was sent to the community of Tiberias, of Tveria. But he instructed the courier, the messenger, the one that was taking this invite, or the summons, he instructed him that he should not hand it to the Jewish people until the evening of Shabbos. That means until it's right by the beginning of Shabbos, Friday night, he should hand it to them. He knew, or maybe right before Shabbos, and he knew that the Jewish people can't travel on Shabbos. So they're not going to be able to leave until Matzah Shabbos, until Saturday night, till after Shabbos. And even if they would travel all night, they wouldn't make it on time. Once they're not making it on time, he can have a libel against them that they did not listen to the summons. They didn't show up on time with the summons of the king, and the date was dated that they would have given them enough time to come, and they didn't come. That was his scheme that he wanted to get them in trouble. So the Medrash says that Reb Shmuel Bar Nachman went down to bathe in the river. Which river is maybe? It's not the Kinneret. Maybe it's the Jordan. I'm not exactly sure. He went down to the river, and he saw Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Also, why did he go to the river? He went there to Tevel in the mikveh. He went to bathe before Shabbos. He sees Rebbe, and he sees Rebbe's face is very sullen. Rebbe looks very down. He looked ill. So he says, Rebbe, why do you look this way? So Rebbe answered him, well, we got this letter from the king. And obviously he said, it's impossible for us to make it there. We're going to be in trouble. So Reb Shmuel Bar Nachman said to him, let's not be worried, the Eibishter is going to do miracles for us. Fine. They went in to bathe. I guess in addition to the river, there was also a bathhouse there. They went in to bathe in the bathhouse, and then they would go out and maybe toivel in the mikveh in the river. So when they came over there, there was this this spirit that appeared to them, and the Mefarshim, different opinions of what this exactly means, but it was the demon of the bathhouse. See, one of the exciting things that they used to have in the old days that we don't get to experience these days, thank God, and that is called the demon of a bathhouse. What exactly that demon looks like, I don't know, but you don't want to be alone in the bathhouse with the demon of the bathhouse. Anyways, this demon starts making trouble. But the trouble that he made was that he was dancing around and he was being a lunatic. And so Rebbe wanted to yell at him. So Reb Shmuel Bar Nachman tells Rebbe, he says, leave him alone. I think miracles are going to come from him. So then Reb Shmuel, I think it was Reb Shmuel, said to him, your master, I guess Rebbe, your master is sad. He's in trouble. And you're dancing? So he said, don't worry, he said. You can go, you can eat, and this is what this demon says. I know what's going on. You can eat and you can drink. You can have a good Shabbos because your master, which is God, is going to make miracles for you. And I'm going to be his agent. And I am going to put you on Sunday morning. I'm going to get you to where you need to be on time. So Shabbos was over. After they finished saying the Sidure. Sidure is the special extra prayers we say Matzah Shabbos. After the evening service, we add a special thing. So after they finished saying that, in other words, Shabbos was totally over, he went and he lifted them up and he brought them in front of before Peli Dipanyos. I guess that's in front of the gates, in front of the entrance of this place called Panyos or Pamyos, which we said earlier where the king was. So the servants came to the king. And they said to him, they're here. The Jews are here. They're here for their meeting. So he said, quickly go and close the gates to the city. I guess they first had to go to the city. And then he said, shut the gates. Don't let them in. So what did he do? He went. So he picked them up. This guy was still working for them, this demon. He picked them up and he put them in the middle of the city. I mean, he got them over the fence, over the wall, and he put them in the middle of the city. So now they were in already there. He couldn't hold them back anymore. So again, the servants come and they say these guys are here. So he says, "Well, I can't see these Jews as they are. They need to go bathe first." He said, "Go heat up but tell them that tell them I'm going to see them, but they first have to bathe. But I want the bathhouse to be really ready for them." He said, go heat it up for 3 days. According to some, he told them to heat it up for a week. What he wanted was that they should be forced to go to that bathhouse and then they'd get burnt in there from the unbearable heat, from it being warm for such a long time. So what happened? This demon came to the bathhouse, and I guess he knew the ins and outs of a bathhouse because he was the bathhouse demon. So he managed to get a hold of the cold water. And as they were heating it up, he kept on pouring in cold buckets of water. So he cooled the water. He didn't let it get too hot. So when they came in, when Rebbe, and I guess Rebbe was the, I guess it was Rebbe together with Shmuel Bar Nachman, came into the water, they were able to bathe and everything was fine. Then they came in front of the king. So the king realized that he couldn't beat them. No matter what he tried. First of all, they showed up in time. Then he tried to keep them out of the city. They somehow got into the city. Then he tried to burn them in the bathhouse. And they survived. They're here. They're looking really well. And all kempt and clean and fine. So he realized that his tricks didn't work. So he turned to them and he said like this. Just because your master, your God, does miracles for you, does that give you a right? Does that give you a right to make fun of a king? Or does that give you the right to where is he used? Does that give you a right? Hey, hold on. Are you allowed to cheapen? Are you allowed to be makel? Are you allowed to be cheapen your behavior in front of the king? To act disrespectful to the king? So they said to him, they realized, you know, the shame. They knew what he's talking about. But they were disrespectful to him when he was a shepherd of the pigs. So they said to him, no. To Diklatinos, the pig shepherd, we were disrespectful. But to Diklatinos, the emperor, to him we have all the awe and all of respect. So he said to them, okay, I hear you. But still, this should teach you a lesson that never to start up with a young Roman and never to start up even with a gulayer za'ir, which means, as the Mefarshim say, that means do never act inappropriately to even a weak person, a lowly person, because you never know what's going to be. Okay, that was the lesson. God saved them. They were protected. That's the story. Now, every story in the Midrash has a deeper meaning. What was the inner story going on over here? So the Chassam Sofer, the great rabbi, right, of the 19th century, early 19th century, Rav Moshe Sofer. So the Chassam Sofer explains this story as follows. Because he asks the question, he says, "Say, why does the guy have to come and libel upon them? If he wants to punish them, he has enough reason to punish them. They beat him up. They mistreated him. He could have called them in and said, listen here, this is what you've done to me. I mean, these emperors didn't need much of an excuse to do anything to anybody. So, especially if he's angry at them and he wants vengeance, so he could have just done something. Why does he have to make this whole story upon them? What does he have to do this whole situation?" And what's the answer they told him? You know, they told him an answer. We started up with Diclunius the shepherd, but we would never start up with Diclunius the emperor. And he doesn't know that they can answer that answer. That when they beat him up, they didn't know that he's the king. It's obvious an answer. So what's this that they told him and they answered him? So he explains as follows, a very interesting idea. He says, the Jewish people are meant to be Hashem select. God is the king over the world, and God appointed the Jewish people as a king over the nations. We just are standing now, just moments, days before the giving of the Torah. In this time, right before, this literally these days, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, is when Hashem said to the Jewish people, "Va'atem tiyem li, you're going to be to me mamleches kohanim, a kingdom, a nation of kings, or a nation, a kingdom of ministers." So the Jewish people are meant to minister over the nations. Mamleches kohanim means that you will be a kings over the entire world, over the 70 nations. There's another pasuk he brings from Vayikra. It says, God says, "I am God, your God. I've taken you out of the land of Egypt in front of the eyes of the nations to be to them for a God." Simply the way we learn the pasuk is, I took you out in front of everybody to see so that Hashem can be to the Jewish people for a God. But he's learning, no, liyos lachem lelokim, that the Jewish people can be administrators or a rulers over all of the world, obviously for the sake of elevating humanity. And therefore he says, if anybody of the nations, any Gentile, starts up with any Jew, even the most minor, even the most, we might say, the simplest or the most, if possibly to say about a Jew, insignificant, God forbid, that can't be insignificant, but what we might think is someone the least of the Jewish community, so that is liable as if the person rebelled against the king himself. Because the Jewish people are a kingdom, are a people of kings. However, what did the Roman, and the Roman knew that, he knew the status of the Jewish people. What the emperor, however, thought was that is as will only be or was at the time when the Jewish people are in their heights, when the Jewish people are the days of Mashiach or the days of King Solomon, the Beis HaMikdash. So in that time when God has elevated the Jewish people and their power and their light and their wisdom and their knowledge is manifest openly for the whole world to see. But during the time of exile, when Esav subdues Yaakov, when the Gentiles and the Romans, led by the Romans, subdue the Jewish people, he thought that means that it's a true subservience. And at that time, the Jew is not king, and who becomes king? Esav is king. And if Esav is king, it means his descendants are king. That means the Romans are the kings. And the Jewish people have to treat the Romans as if, you know, they're the majesty, they're the king. And quite on the contrary, same idea. If a Jew hits the most minor or mistreats even the most minor of the Gentiles, it's considered as if they rebelled against the king, against royalty. And which is, obviously, carries the biggest punishment. In other words, he said, his opinion was that the Jewish sovereignty, this holy sovereignty, representing God's kingship over the world, is something that is dependent on the condition of the Jewish people. It's not an inherent thing, an absolute thing that will always be. It's dependent in the various different eras, in the different time. He acknowledged the concept, but he thought it's limited to only a particular time. Therefore, he felt that in the time what we were talking about then, when the Jewish kingdom has fallen, the temple has been destroyed, the galus has already started, at that time, the Jew takes a second place, second status, or a lower place in the world, in which he is the servant of those, at least of the dynasty of Rome or the dynasty of Esav. That was his thought. And even though he thought, he said, listen here, he appreciated and understood that this kingdom eventually is going to go back to the Jewish people. And in that sense, he appreciated that what? And that's the reason why the story emphasizes that he was a shepherd of pigs. We mentioned already a few times in earlier classes, the pig in Hebrew is the word chazir, and Esav is compared to the pig because chazir means he will return, which means he will return the rulership to his brother Yaakov. His rule is a temporary rule, and eventually kingship, he has to restore it to the rightful owner, which is the Jewish people. So he appreciated and he understood that the Jews can say that you're not really, you're only holding a temporary, it's only been taken away from us temporarily, and since it's meant to come back to us, it's as if we are remain kings all the time. We are in dominant, we are in control, we're the ruling class all the time, because eventually it's going to come back. He appreciated, he understood that they would be able to say that. So in order to avoid that, he played this whole game with them by inviting them in a manner in which they couldn't reach his palace on time. So again, he sent this letter to invite them, as we said earlier, on Erev Shabbos, which means right before Shabbos begins. And as we said earlier, even when they would leave at the conclusion of Shabbos, they wouldn't get there on time. And if they, and what would be their excuse? They would say, listen here, it's a long way, and we could not, in this time that we were able to travel, you made it impossible for us to come. It's a long way. You didn't give us enough time to arrive. And what would he bring out from that? What was he trying to, the message that he was conveying? That just like the distance between you and me, for you to come to me, is too far for you to come, and you couldn't speed it up to get here on time. The same is also the distance between when you retrieve your empire and you become kings again is still very, very far away. And it's going to take a very long time for you to be able to take it. And if that's the case, then you are not kings now, because it's not within your control to speed that up. It's not within your abilities. So you have no access to kingship now. Then what are you really? You're really our servant. And if that's the case, you deserve punishment for having mistreated me, even though I wasn't king then. Even though I was just a simple shepherd, it's a national thing. It's the nation of the Jewish people are subservient to the sovereignty of the Gentile people. So, and again, even though this might change, this is only going to change in the end of time. It's not going to change at that time. And therefore, at least for the time being, our our rulership is real and true. Just like you couldn't speed it up when you needed to get to me. But what happened? The miracle came about and God flipped it over and enabled the rabbis to arrive miraculously. So it let the steam out of the whole argument because they did arrive on time. Which means, and what did that spiritually mean? First of all, he couldn't use that to prove it to them that you're just like you're, but they proved the opposite. What they proved the opposite was that there's no obstacles for the Jewish people. Meaning to say that even this, that for there is a decreed exile upon the Jewish people, it's not an inherent thing that must be. And any moment it can change. Why? Because we can speed up the redemption. And we know that is, if Jewish people would have put in the work that they needed to do and done tshuva and done the rectifications that we should have done, we could have had a much shorter exile. And at any moment in the exile, we could have turned everything around with the proper tshuva. Which means that we have, it is within the Jewish people's reach to take back the kingship from Esau. The fact that they didn't is sad, but that doesn't change the fact that it's within their reach. And therefore, there is no true dominance, because when something can change and it's within your power, then that means that to a certain degree it's as if it is already. So that means that the kingship was never truly given to Esau. And that's why they concluded, and they said like this: true, to a true king we are subservient, but to a shepherd of pigs, which means to someone who's going to eventually have to give back the kingdom, like we spoke before, what chazar means, the kingdom, to that king we don't owe anything to. That was the idea. And indicating the general theme and the idea that the Jewish people always remain the royal class throughout the entire exile, even during the times of the worst persecutions and even during the times of the harshest periods. It's a very interesting idea. That's how he discusses and explains this thing. Now, in the next verse we were holding, Pasuk says, V'achreichein, and afterwards Yatza Achiv, his brother, came out. V'yodai, and his hand, Echezes Barkev, Esav, was holding on to the heel of Esav. V'yikra Shema Yaakov, and he called him Yaakov. Who called him Yaakov? Now the simple reason why he called him Yaakov comes from the word Ekev. Ekev means heels. Yaakov is holding on to Esav's heel. So who called him Yaakov? So it's either Yitzchak, his father, V'yikra means he called him. It's either Yitzchak, or according to some opinions, it's God. It doesn't say Yitzchak called him. Yikra, he called him, referring to Hashem, named him Yaakov. But then the pasuk concludes, V'yitzchak ben Shishim Shana beledes Oisim. Yitzchak was 60 years old when they were born. Obviously, this verse, again, this word verse and last verse, these are powerful, powerful, powerful verses and psukim indicating the future, and not just indicating the future, but relating to the times that we're in, literally living right now. We're living these prophecies right now. Because we are holding now exactly at the junction of the completion of the kingdom of Esau, which its last manifestation is America, and its final kingdom as it's going to roll its kingship over to Israel, to the Jewish people, and to Mashiach Tzidkenu, Mashiach, Messiah, who is going to take the reins from Esav. So the Gemara says, Rashi brings, the reason that the significance of Yaakov holding on to Esav's leg is an indication that the heel, that means that Esav is not going to have a chance to complete his kingdom before Jacob takes over. That means it's going to be still during, it's not going to be like the kingdom of Esav is going to be, is going to disintegrate, is going to collapse. And then we're going to have a period of time of no rulership, no kingdom, and then eventually the Jewish people will take the reins of kingship in the world. Mashiach will take the reins of kingship in the world. No, it's going to flow one from the other. Esav has not been completely, his kingship didn't fall apart. It's just at the end, but it hasn't yet. And from within the kingship of Esav will come the kingship of Jacob, of Yaakov. And exactly, and again, the exciting thing is We are seeing this happen right now. We're seeing the first of all, the coming together of these two forces of Yaakov and Esau. But it's, in a sense, a handing over of authority. And a handing over of power. Not in a way that threatens Esau, quite on the contrary. Esau is going to appreciate it once Yaakov takes over and starts leading the world in the godliest and greatest way possible. So now, I'd like to share with you an interesting, again, this is a passage in the Midrash. The Midrash tells us as follows. Hegmon Echad. One hegmon. Who's a hegmon? A hegmon is a officer, like a Roman head, an officer appointed by the Romans, a governor, some kind of a. That's a hegmon. Usually, these guys were tyrants. They were really, 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 really horrific to the Jewish people that were under their rule. Anyways, Shaul Achad min Ilan de Beis Saluni. He asked a question to one of the Jewish rabbis from Beis Saluni. Now, there are other versions that say that he asked a question to Rabbi Meir, and there are other versions that say that he asked a question to Rabbi Gamliel. Either or, it's Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Gamliel, one of the great Jewish rabbis. And what was his question? Amar lo, he said to him, Mi toifes ha-malchus acharenu. Who is going to grab the kingdom after us? When our kingship is over, after we're done ruling, when our rulership is over on the world, who is going to take it over after us? Hevi Nayar Cholok. So this is Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Meir went and took a clean paper, or parchment, or whatever, that had nothing written on it. Venatal Kulmus, and he took a Kulmus as a writing device, whatever it was. Vekasav Olav, and he wrote this verse. Afterwards, his brother came out, and his hands are holding on to the heel of Esav, basically showing him, take a look, the heel represents the end, like a person, the heel is at the bottom. In the end of days, when Esav's kingdom is going to come to an end, Yadoi, whose hand? The hand meaning power. Yaakov is gripping the feet of Esav, is because then is when Yaakov is going to ascend to rulership and to kingship. This is what he said. Amru, they said. Who are the they? It could be his students who said this, or it could be the Romans who said this. Ru'u devarim yeshenem, take a look at something of old, ancient stuff, mepizakan chadash, from a new old man. He's a new guy here, and he's telling us ancient things from way back then. And then the Medrash concludes, this comes to let you know, this comes to inform you, how much pain this tzaddik endured. How much pain did this righteous person endure? It's a little hard to understand what the Medrash is saying, and there's a lot of commentary on this Medrash. And I'd like to both spend this class, the rest of this class, and next class, next week, explaining this idea of what is happening over here. The first thing we need to understand is this whole thing is very strange, that he asked him a question. Who is going to be the next ruler? So he should, if he has an answer, he says, well, it's us. He should have said so. And if he wants to prove it from a verse, he should have said Genesis, Bereshis, chapter 25, verse 26, says clearly that afterwards Yaakov is holding on to the heel of Esav, which is indicating that he's going to take over the kingship. Doesn't do that. He brings a paper and he writes it down on the paper. And not only does the Medrash emphasize that he wrote it instead of just saying it, and he shows it to him. But the Medrash emphasized that it was a new piece of paper. Naya Cholok means it wasn't the paper that was once erased. It was a new piece of paper in which he wrote it. He wrote it with a pen. Very strange that he had to write, that the Medrash has to say that. And then we need to understand, what is this that they mean, their answer, when they say, take a look, a new sage telling us an old, ancient ancient scripture? Are they criticizing him? What are you telling us? It's an old story. Then if you know it already, why are you asking? Like, what exactly, what do they mean by that? And what does the Medrash also mean when the Medrash concludes and it says, take a look how much pain this tzaddik, this righteous person had. How much pain did he endure? Who is the tzaddik that we're referring to who endured the pain that we're talking about? So these are all just a few things that the commentators all try to figure out in the Medrash. Obviously, there's a deep secret in this Medrash, and let's see if we can unlock its mysterious meaning. So, on the simple thing, when he says a new sage telling us an ancient thing, means it's an old verse. It's a verse that's been in there, you know, the time when the Roman was talking to him, the Torah was given already about 1,500 years before that. So he's saying it's an ancient verse, but no one interpreted it well. No one understood the meaning. I'm telling a story that the second one, Yaakov, is holding on to Esau's heel, but that this means that he's going to take over the kingship at the end. That was the wonderment. It's an old verse, but no one unlocked its secret. No one told us that this is a prophecy about a future kingdom that was going to happen. It could have been an old story about the birth of these two babies. So there is deeper meaning over here. That's what he means. And so it comes out according to that, that they're saying this in terms of exclaiming their wonderment that this has always been there in the pasuk, in the verse, but no one noticed it. It takes a new sage to uncover what has always been there, the prophecy that has always been there. That's one of the explanations. And when it says, take a look at the tzaddik, how much pain the tzaddik had, this is referring to Jacob, the tzaddik, that the pain meaning, when he's already only being born, he's already cognizant, he's already aware of the suffering that he's going to endure, and that he's not going to gain master over his older brother who had Esav at that time before he was rectified was a real brute, that he's not going to gain mastery. Quite on the contrary, Esav is going to trample him and make him suffer only till the end of days. And you see that from the fact that he didn't grab him higher in the body, he grabbed him in the heel, appreciating and understanding that it's going to take a very long time. So take a look how much pain the tzaddik had, Jacob the tzaddik, that he knew that his goodness is only going to happen in the end of time. And he's going to have to wait. That's the pain. That's the pirush of the Matnas Kahuna. The Yedei Moshe is another pirush on the Midrash. He wants to learn that when it says take a look at the pain that the tzaddik is enduring, it's not referring to Yaakov the tzaddik. It's referring to this sage who answered the Roman, the Roman who presented the question. This sage who answered, who responded, he endured pain. Why? Because the Romans then were killing Jews right and left. And when they asked the question, who's going to take over the kingdom after us, you knew that they're not up to any good, right? And if he's going to tell them, so he could have kind of said, how am I supposed to know? How in the world am I supposed to know? Am I a prophet or something? We'll wait and see. We'll see when your kingdom is over, who's going to take over. The fact that Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Gamliel went and didn't hide the truth. He told it to him as it is. The prophecy of God is that the Jewish people will overthrow your empire and will take it over, and the Jewish people will rule. And to say that to the Roman legions at that time meant was suicidal. And not only that, he could have tortured him to death. And yet the sage said it anyways because he felt it needs to be said. And that's the meaning of kamatsar, how much pain it stir. This individual had tsar, had pain. This is this pain that we're talking about, that he was willing to endure and not hide the truth. So this is the tzaddik that endured the pain. Another commentator on the... So far we haven't had any explanations on why he took a clean piece of paper and why he wrote it and so on and so forth. So the Yafas Toar, again another common one of the commentators of Midrash, says that the significance of that clean paper and the kulmis was as follows. The question over here is when the Torah tells us a detail about the birth of these two twins, is it just a story of the past, a nice little incident when the babies were born, that Esav is the first one to come out and Yaakov follows and he's holding on to him? And it's a nice story. Who says that this is a prophecy, that this is symbolic of some deeper truth, of something that's going to materialize after 4,000 years of human history? Think about it. That little event, who says it's serious? That's why, in order to show him, if he was going to tell him just the answer, and he's going to tell him, well, it says so-and-so, he would say, well, how do I know that? Like, what's the proof that that this is symbolic, or this is what it means? You're reading too much into it. That's what the guy would say. Who tells you this? So therefore, he on purposely, wisely, took a clean piece of paper and wrote it. But basically saying is, like, why the Torah that is a guidance to the world, the Torah that's the most studied book in all of history, why would the Torah, and we know how careful and concise the Torah is, so why would the Torah tell us a detail which doesn't seem to have any significance and any importance? I mean, who cares in which position? The main thing is that Esau was the first one to be born. Yaakov was born after him. What's the idea that his whole hand is holding on to him? So when the Torah says something, we know it has to have significance. To prove to him this idea that when the Torah says something, it has to have significance. So he went and he took a clean piece of paper. A clean piece of paper meaning, and a pen with ink, with a quill. He took a quill and a new one. Now, no one wants to, and he took a new one. He didn't take an old one. The Medrash, it was a chanayah chalak, a new one. An old one means, okay, you know, what is it called when people are just squibbling, or what is the word? Whatever, I forgot what the word is. Wasting it because it's old. But a fine piece of parchment and new ink and so forth, and just to waste it, you know, you wouldn't waste it. So with this, he was indicating to the governor that just like this is not, you know, if I'm taking a new parchment because I want to give a significant message. And when I'm taking a new parchment, this is an important document. So too, the Torah is an important document. The Torah would not write this had it not have historical significance for all future. And the Torah is giving us a very deep message of what's going to happen. True, you guys are mighty, you're powerful, you're strong, you think you can do whatever you want and get away with it. But you should understand that you should know the day will come when Yaakov is going to take the kingship back from Esau and reassert himself. And that was the significance of this thing. Okay, there's much more to talk about this Medrash and the significance of what it means. Really, really fascinating stuff. But we're going to leave this Bezrat Hashem for next class. Please join us next week for Mashiach Matters on Thursday, 12:15. Thank you. Meanwhile, have a good Yom Tov and a very, very happy Shavuos. May we merit that on this powerful, powerful time, we should already merit to see the rise of Yaakov, the rise of Moshiach, and the transformation of all of mankind.